G'day everyone, it is Wednesday, August 3, the Big Sports Breakfast, Sky Sports Radio. A very good morning, however, and wherever you're listening this morning. We are rolling through the guest co-hosts with Clarkie. I've just heard from him, by the way. He's just sent me a WhatsApp picture of some exotic Italian coastal location. Well, I actually don't know where he is, but it looks like somewhere like that. And he says he misses us, but I doubt it. But anyway, Loz, we've got the great Paul Gow, who's been an ornament to this show for, well, Gowie, morning to you. Tell morning. Us how long.
Well, I've been here since 1999. They started back in the Parramatta days when Rabs was in there and TK, came out a couple of years later, but I think the great Mario was in there and I thought it was fantastic. When I started on tour in 2000, they said, we want you to do a bit of a cross with the golf from the US and we're going to pay you. You're going to pay me? That's an outrage.
Well, it's not a cross today, mate. You're here for 3.5 hours and we need some of your best.
Yeah, I don't know if I got a lot. But hey, well done to you guys getting out of bed at that time because that's ridiculous. Who gets out of bed at 3:35? Like, that's not right at any stage.
Just don't have a sleep this afternoon. If you have a sleep this afternoon, mate, you will not sleep tonight.
No, I'm going to attempt a game of golf this afternoon, something I haven't done for quite some time.
Now, how is your golf going?
Well, it's not great. It's not great because the weather's been awful and the COVID hit. I was going to try to be a touring golf professional again back in 2020 when I turned 50, but COVID hit and then the tour stopped and all that sort of stuff.
So no ambition to get back on it?
It is, but it might be next year now. So right. I could be the oldest rookie ever for the Champions Tour, the old man's tour.
Well, it's great to have you in, Gowie. And, well, your Parramatta Eels, they've been, well, how have they been this year? Because, one week, they're very inconsistent, to say the least, but Loz still thinks they can win the comp. How do you feel about them?
Did you say that?
No. I believe that the Eels can. And I'll base that on three victories they've had this year, and two in particular at the start of the year against Penrith and Melbourne Storm, and then they beat Penrith last week. Look, they still have to play a lot better than what they're playing, and I still have some doubts about the style of football that they play. But I believe when Parramatta are at their best, they play a power game, and I know they can be a skillful team, but sometimes to me they look too structured. And when they play with that structure of moving the football and trying to create space down the edge, I don't think it suits them. But I like it when they can create some offloads and play off the back of that. Play more ad-lib football. I think that suits getting Moses, Dylan Brown, Gutho, all these players into a contest. I think it suits them. Their forwards can all offload and they're all very skillful. I just don't think we see enough of that style of footy for Parramatta. You know, history will tell you that, you need to defend well, but you can defend well for a four-week period. I think if you look at the West Tigers back in 2005, I think they averaged something close to nearly 30 points a game in the regular season. But they got to the semis and they averaged about 10 or 12 points in those semi-finals. So you can do it. And again, you want to see it consistently. But if they can get their attack right and you back your attack to give you energy in defence, like some teams build their energy in attack off their defence. Parramatta, to me, I think when they play powerful and aggressive in everything that they do, that's when they're at their absolute peak. And they showed it last year in the semis, a couple of games. I thought they were unlucky against Penrith. They should have won that game. You still got some question marks about, whether they can deliver under pressure in pressure moments.
I was at the Parramatta Golf Day there a month ago after they got smashed by the Bulldogs, and I was interviewing Sean Lane and Mitchell Moses, and the question was, because there was fans there, there's sponsors there, was what sort of, effort was that, and they said, well, we just didn't turn up. What does that mean, I just didn't turn up? Because as a golfer, it's just us, right? I've got to turn up, I've got a caddy there. I've got to get out of bed with the most enthusiasm possible. I've got to get to the first tee with the most enthusiasm. I've got to put as much effort into that 5 hours of golf possible to get as much out of that because that's how I get paid. When I hear the words as a fan of the game that, we just didn't turn up today, what does that mean?
It means their preparation hasn't been great and they still haven't worked out what the best preparation is for them.
So who does that come down to? Does it come down to coaching staff? Does it come down to the individual?
Well, it comes
down
to... Because
you're a team, not an individual.
Well, it comes down to everyone, but at the end of the day, the individual, he knows what he's doing away from training. The coach can only do so much. The coach is not with you 24 hours. So the coach can give you all the right tools. You can do the right things on the training paddock, but he's not with you seeing what you're eating for lunch. He's not there with you seeing what time you go to bed. He can tell you all the right things, dude. He can tell you the right time to go to bed. He can tell you how much or many hours you need to get to sleep. He can tell you, you know, how much video review you have to do on opposition players and how much extra you have to do at home. And coaches send clips now to players over the phone, on their laptops. So they're getting all this information. At the end of the day, you are responsible for your own performance. And it is a cop-out when you say, we just didn't turn up today. Because the coaching group prepare you to go out there and play, but it's the individuals that haven't prepared right. Some days when they go out there and play well, you ask them what their preparation was like, what the attitude was like in a dressing shed before they play, you know, Penrith and Melbourne Storm this year compared to when they played the Bulldogs or the Tigers who they lost to. And they would tell you what the difference in intensity was throughout the week. They'd tell you what the intensity was like in the dressing shed, whether it was calm, whether there was a lot of voices, whatever it was. You know the difference between when you're on and when you're off. And if you're off regularly, there's an issue with how you prepare.
Yeah.
And it's not anything to do with the coaching staff.
Right. Well, that comes back to an individual thing, doesn't it? It's, you know...
Because, again, Gary, as a coach, I can imagine Brad Arthur, any coach in the NRL is preparing his team very well. But they can't control what you do in your spare time with the way that you prepare.
Well, that was one of the amazing bits. When I first got to the US tour, I thought I was the only... Because I worked pretty hard at the game. I thought I was doing all the extras without anyone knowing. In your hotel room, sit-ups, turning the bed up on its side and chipping into the wall and doing all that sort of fun stuff. And I'm thinking, I'm the only bugger that does this. And then I started to talk to other players. And then I realised they're all doing it. There was a handful that aren't doing it. And they're legends. They're like, oh, I don't have to do that because I'm so talented. But majority, I'm saying 95% of them, were doing extras. And it was about your preparation. If you haven't got your preparation, you've got nothing in golf. And obviously it's the same in all sports.
Yeah. And again, you know, you talk about, you know, team sacrifice plays. You know, how many Parramatta players at times are prepared to do the team thing, not the individual thing? And all the good sides, when they're having success, it's everyone putting their ego in their back pocket. And if it's your turn... for, say, being the kick pressure player, well, you're going to go.
Yeah.
No matter how buggered you are, when you're in that position and it's fourth or fifth tackle and someone is lining up for kick, you're coming from the inside, you're going to get out and at least try and put pressure on him. Mm. Even when you're fatigued, you know, you've got to get behind the ball as early as you possibly can. You've got to hold your position in the defensive line. You've got to have good line speed. All the things that coaches talk about, you know, that... at times, just comes down to the individual. And if coaches are strong enough, they go, well, you know, if you're not going to do it for me, you might bring other things to the game. Mm. But these are the non-negotiables that we expect as a unit. And that's why Melbourne have had success for such a long period of time. They talk about next man up. Well, they give them a simple role and a simple job. And they say, X, Y, Z, that's all you need to do today. Anything else is a bonus. Yeah, but if you bring this, we're going to be happy. That's what we're going to mark you on.
Apologies, by the way. I can tell by the text messages we had some audio issues at the start, but we're pretty much all good now, I'm sure. And a text from Booty here. Morning, guys. Gowie, you hit the nail on the head. You go out and have to play well to earn prize money. These players are already paid in advance, regardless how they play, and that's why they need to go back to match payments for wins and losses, says Booty. Don't think we'll ever see that. I'm sure the Players Association would get up and down about that. And golf is an individual sport, of course. But you spoke about, you know, chipping in your hotel room, etc. Who were some of the most fanatical players you ever saw, Gowie?
Oh, fanatical in the sense of getting the most out of it. Well, Vijay Singh, which is, you know, documented. I tried one time at Memphis. I thought, I'm going to out-practice him on the practice fairway. I've got him covered. I'm going to stay here until dark. He got me. I couldn't go anymore. My back and my hands and my arms were killing me. He was just an absolute machine because he would finish a practice session after he'd played and then he'd go to the gym and then it'd be 11 o'clock wind up and I didn't get any, like he didn't get any sleep. But one of the amazing things I seen, Tiger Woods lived down the road from me at a golf course called Iworth. And I quite often went down there, you know, for a game here and there. And I rocked up one day at about 8:30 in the morning. He's down on the practice fairway or chipping green, hitting this certain chip shot over a bunker off a downhill slope. And he's going through very methodical on how he'd do it during the game when you were playing. Anyway, I leave. I go and play with some mates. We have some lunch. I have a couple of bourbons. I think I'll go back down and see if Tiger's on the range. And it's now like 3:30. And Tiger's there hitting that same shot. And he's pulling the ball out, going through the routine, the whole lot. And the young kid that's picking up the balls there is walking past. I said, mate, has Tiger been doing that all day? And he goes, oh, no, no, no. He went home for lunch for 45 minutes. And I went, wow, when did he get here? He said, he got here at 5 o'clock this morning. Oh. I said, has he been doing that shot all day? He goes, oh, yeah, that's the shot he's been doing all day. I went,
That's
okay, hands up. Yeah. Now I know why. So when you talk about preparation.
But I think you've got to find your own preparation as well.
You do, yeah.
Because it's like, say, a horse trainer. If you've got a horse and you're successful with that horse and you think, well, you watch them and you think they're only doing three laps of the track and you think, oh, well, that's the way I'll train. They just do three laps. That horse mightn't respond to that.
Yeah.
So as a player, just because you're hitting the ball for 4 hours, doing one shot, that necessarily is not going to work.
No, 100% not.
For me. Yeah. So you're going to find at some point in time, how do I use my time with my preparation to get me in the right frame of mind to go out there and play well?
That's right.
So I think that's the key as well. You just can't expect, because the world's greatest halfback is doing this, that's what I'm going to do. It might work for the halfback you got, but you might have to trigger him with something else. You might have to mix and match until you find what gets him in the zone, what is his best preparation, how do we go about getting him switched on for training, and then he brings it to the game. You just can't assume that one style and one prep is going to work for everyone.
Hey, and that's the thing of aging and learning, isn't it? Because the more I got away from golf and sat at the outside, I actually look back at my career and go, well, mate, I think you hit too many golf balls at this time. You didn't do enough mental side of the game. You might not done enough nutrition side of the game. So I was following a path of, Peter Lonard, Anthony Painter, Greg Norman, Wayne Grady, guys who just practiced really hard. And I think, oh, that's the way. And the great Ben Hogan said, oh, it's in the dirt. You've got to practice really hard to do it. So that's the mentality I had. Now, the more I look at the young guys that play today, they actually don't do it like that. They do it more like the Australian cricket team. There's only a certain amount of reps they do. And then they do other stuff, believe it or not. So each their own, because there's some players that actually doesn't suit. They've got to spend another couple of hours on the practice fairway because they get a little bit more confidence out of hitting a few more balls. But pretty much the high performance stuff these days is over there do 10 push-ups, over there do 4 chips, that sort of stuff. I'm not a total believer, but I think there's a certain time that you push yourself out. And it's like horse trainers. I find them fascinating. You know, they're the best athletes in the world, the horses, because to prep them for a Melbourne Cup or a Slipper or an Everest is unbelievable how they can prep them. We tried it in golf. I tried it in golf with my trainer, and we prepped pretty damn well. We're trying to prep this year. It was about 2001 or 2 for the Greg Norman Classic, which was the big money event. It was $2 million. The week before, six weeks before, we were prepping for that. But I'd come good the week before, which was in Perth, which was the Vines, the Heineken Classic, and I ran fourth. And the next week, I just fell off the cliff. So I'd overtrain, and like, I'd just come off the other side. I found it fascinating. I'm like, imagine what they do with racehorses. Like, those trainers are amazing to get that horse ready for that exact day.
Peaking on the right day.
And that's why when you hear a trainer go, this is its grand final day, the time to get on. But often we find something else we like and ignore it. Anyway, well, would you believe sport and politics mixing on the front pages of the papers again? Bit of a different subject matter to what we were dealing with last week at Manly, but this is in relation to the grand final. So front page of the Telegraph, league bombshell, Dom's war on footy, Premier's stadium delay ignites almighty legal battle with NRL, front page of the Herald, NRL holds Premier to ransom on stadiums, grand final threat. So these reports saying that Dominic Perrottet, the New South Wales Premier, set to renege on a $250 million commitment to upgrade suburban stadiums, and those specifically being Brookvale, Shark Park and Leichhardt. And as a result, the NRL could end up just taking the grand final to Brisbane then, because they're saying, well, Peter Volandis, the ARL Commission Chairman, saying that the commitment is tied to the commitment to have the grand final in Sydney ongoing is tied to this suburban stadium cash. So this is going to be an interesting couple of days between the NRL and the state government, because I won't be surprised if the NRL just goes, well, stuff this, let's take it to Brisbane. It worked there last year. Magic Round's obviously been extremely successful and has shown that Sydney siders would travel to watch their teams play in a grand final. Last year was different due to the fact that, you know, we had COVID lockdowns, etc., and it was difficult to cross state borders at the time. And
it's probably a way of the future too, Mido, to be perfectly honest. It's probably something that they've discussed internally for a while. Why do we continually have the grand final here in Sydney? I hope we can have it here in Sydney. I want it to be in Sydney. But I reckon, you know, stadiums around Australia and possibly in New Zealand would pay a lot of money to have a grand final, host a grand final. And with the war going on at the moment and with the government reneging on the deal that was promised to the NRL, these clubs thought they were going to get an upgraded stadium. And I know things have changed too since that agreement was put in place, but I don't think you'll see Peter Volandis backing down. I think he'll go through with the threat. If they don't get the money, then the grand final will be taken on the road. And I think that other states would pay a lot of money to have the game there.
Well, you sort of look at, if they want to grow the game and they're talking about adding more teams to, like, maybe the Bears go to New Zealand, growing the game means moving it around possibly. So if you do go to Brisbane, does it add a couple of more teams up in Queensland that then really makes it a more of a national?
Well, we've seen it in State of Origin, haven't we now?
It's strong.
More or less now, one game in Sydney, one game in Queensland, and one at a neutral venue. And I don't know how long that's locked in for, but it seems as though that's the way of the future. But the clubs, in particular the Sharks, Manly and the West Tigers, they're not happy because they believe that they were going to get a rebuild or an upgrade of their stadiums. And it's not only NRL clubs, but it's for women's football, it's for soccer, it's for a lot of other sports that they host. And you know, suburban footy, it's good watching two teams run around when it's a suburban stadium with 18,000 to 20,000 people, and the tribalism is there, and it looks a great atmosphere. But I understand why they want to upgrade them, because the facilities aren't great.
I went to Norse last year and watched a Canterbury Cup game. Norse were playing the Jets, and it was after Tommy Radonjic had passed away, and there's about 5,000 or 6,000 people there. It was great, like a little suburbia like that. But if you want to go to the next level, you'll have to build it out.
Yeah,
some time if you want.
And the other thing is too, Gowie, as well, is that you go to Com Stadium.
Yep.
Combank Stadium. And I've been there, two or three times.
Mate, amazing.
That is an amazing stadium. amazing stadium.
Yeah, I like how you can get down and get your food and get back in and really not, you can run back and then watch the game in between getting your food. Yeah. And it's fantastic. It'd be nice to have that everywhere. But, hey, not everybody's a rugby league fan, by the way.
No, that's
all of
exactly
our
right.
Taxpaying money that goes into these stadiums, not everybody is a rugby league fan. They could be something else, into the music or whatever they are into, and they don't really care about that as much as us, I guess. Mm.